good to be in front of you all, and we'll see what happens. Right? Like, you know. Anyway, so University Next Door, I'm riffing off a very well-known book by Jim Syer. I'm not really even going to dwell on that. It was more just it was The Universe Next Door, which was kind of an early kind of worldview study, but I'm specifically taking it into the realm of the university. And this is my perspective. I've been, I was never at a private liberal arts college as an undergrad, but I went to large public universities, a UC system, as well as here in the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, where I graduated. I've taught at private colleges at Cornell, and then a smaller one in the West Coast, and now both, you know, not Christian, especially Cornell. I mean, it was founded as an Ivy League expressly without any kind of Christian religious commitment. So there's no religion department at Cornell, right? So it was very intentional. And then I was at the University of Puget Sound, which was Methodist and then lost its way and now went fully secular. So, and there are lots of those. And then now I'm at Pepperdine, which is considered a research, also a teaching college, university they call it, but it's, I don't want to get too lost in this intro, but just so you get a sense of my perspective, I've kind of done a little of everything, but Pepperdine is like a lot of Christian schools that started out as Bible colleges, right? Like Biola, you know, Bible, whatever, of Los Angeles, you know, they call themselves. And then at a certain point, they try to become research universities. Not all of them, but some of them. So that's what Pepperdine did, and then became pretty successful at that. So now it's considered a top-tier university. And the whole ranking system, of course, is totally corrupt, but, you know, there's all that. Did you know it's all voluntary, what they actually submit in terms of their statistics? And yeah. Anyway, so, okay. So that's what it means to be a top-tier school. I don't know. But anyway, I'm looking at it, of course, as a Christian university, which it actually is self-avowed as a Christian university. But, of course, it's a Christian university today, which is everything's changing. And there's some unique challenges. It's actually tied to a denomination, the Churches of Christ, which is a denomination that doesn't call itself a denomination. So there's some unique things there, too. But it is, basically. So that's its kind of background. Though they do not claim to be evangelical, so that's been kind of an interesting thing for me. That's kind of a bad word, a bad term among the Churches of Christ people at Pepperdine. Right? So maybe that's all the background you need, but that's where I'm coming from. So I teach there, but kind of as an outlier. I have more of a Presbyterian background, but because there aren't Church of Christ people that really are qualified to teach in Asian studies, they kind of have to go outside. So they hired me. They also have hired Jewish professors, and you don't have to be a Christian to teach there. You just can't work against kind of the main precepts or teachings of the college, anyway. Okay, so that's my intro. I'm going to look mostly at this idea of modernity and identity politics. And there's been a lot of talk about modernity already, so I'm not going to, you know, spend a whole lot of time bringing everyone up to speed. But let me see. That's a picture, by the way, of Pepperdine. Is it still up there? Okay, good, good. So on my computer, I just press this button and it moves. Okay, good. Okay. So I like graphs. So in order to map my talk, I made this graph. And I'm not going to go over every single item in detail, but there are basically three columns that I created. Well, actually, there are four. The headings on the left, social institution, educational body, ethos, or maybe values you could call it, and then agent. Okay, and then I've got it in three. Now, I'm mostly going to talk about the middle one, the modern public sphere that I'm calling it, and its transition to now, which I just called it the collapse of the modern. I decided not to use any other term for it at the moment. But if it helps, I mean, that's where people say postmodern. Okay, but so the church, as an institution, liberal arts college, which there's a strong Christian connection to that with the church. Truth, goodness, and beauty. There are enough of you that I think have worked in the classical Christian or raised kids that are going to those kind of schools, so you've probably heard that before. A kind of a unity of truth that encompasses all those three areas. And then the Imago Dei, the image of God as the agent, I'm calling it. Okay, so then the next one, and these, of course, don't just cleanly, you know, shift over. There's overlap, and there's continuity still. But I think on its extreme endpoints, what I'm characterizing is accurate. And then you can break it down further if you wish. So under modern public sphere, I've got nation state, which in a lot of theories of modernization, the nation state replaced the church. Right? I mean, of course, there still is the church. But the authority was wrested away, taken away from the church, and given over to the state. So that's the main thing. I'm really intrigued by institutional histories. I think that's really, really important. So maybe that's the first thing I should say, too, that, of course, being a Labrie, you know, we talk a lot about ideas, and that's absolutely, you know, primary. But I feel that if we don't have at least a handle or a sense of what's happening in institutions, it'll be hard for us for those ideas to be grounded or to fully understand what's going on in the world that we live in. So hopefully this will help make a little more sense in that way. And then underneath that, the research university. So this is the development of the new kind of university. And I'm mostly talking about America, but it came from Germany, actually, the German research university, which became the primary kind of model for American higher ed. And that's a huge shift there. And part of that for the ethos is disciplines, right? Specialization. That's part of what we think of, right? You can choose all these different majors and all this kind of different kinds of research is happening at the same time. And then underneath that, pretty much an Enlightenment kind of idea of the agent. I'm using modernity and Enlightenment pretty interchangeably there. So autonoma ratio, autonomous reason, or reason alone, I think is the way Schaeffer talks about it. Then under collapse, let me back up a little bit, sorry. So the main thing I think I want to talk about in terms of the significance of what I call the modern public sphere is that it describes, I think, the university as one of its main institutions, but also the nation state. And what I mean by that is this idea of the modern individual who is separated as an individual, as a private individual, and separated from the public realm. So whether it's you're talking about democracy or you're talking about the way people juggle knowledge and try to figure out, you know, what is truth in the modern public sphere of the university, there's an assumption that there's an individual who is then weighing everything, figuring out what's right, what's wrong, if it's a moral question and that kind of thing, and then making these choices, and ideally in a democracy, then voting, right? So the idea of citizenship is very closely linked to the university and also with the nation state. I hope that made sense. I mean, I got some more slides that'll help unpack that maybe a bit more. Because what I'm claiming, I'm setting kind of a before and after kind of scenario, so that way of organizing modern life is either collapsed or collapsing, like right now, I feel, in many different areas. But I'm looking at education for the most part, and also mostly a philosophic view. So how has the understanding of what the human being is changed? How we don't really talk about truth so much in the research university. I mean, some people are still hanging on to it, actually. But that's one of the things I should mention, too. So it's basically the collapse of this model, which has dominated now for, you know, quite a while, hundreds of years, to what we are in now. So the new ones, then I'll move on. I think I won't spend more time on slides like this, but this is a way of mapping the entire talk, so that's I want to take a little time here. Under the collapse of the modern, I think the primary social institution is media or journalism. And it's been kind of interesting working in academia to see gradually the influence of journalism, right? People are now not exclusively, but writing more like journalists in the academy, right? So it's interesting the way that has shifted. And journalism, it's not a slam on journalism. I mean, journalism is fine as well, but just that it's a different kind of venture, and but journalism has seeped into the university as well. So, and then under the educational body, I don't know how many of you work in administration, but that's been the big story, right, in the university's hospitals as well, I think. It's just skyrocketed, the numbers of administrators that we now employ in the university system. And that there's some valid reasons for that, but that is the market thing. It's not, I'll just tell you, it's not going into faculty, okay? It's going into administration, okay, for whatever reason, okay? Underneath that, the ethos of my talk here I'm looking at is identity politics. So from my point of view, with the collapse of the modern, really, identity politics is an oxymoron. Politics has collapsed, you know, and because of a new notion of what we think the individual is and what identity is. So I'm comparing it with, I'm saying versus social justice. We still say social justice and, you know, the social justice warriors, which you may have heard about, that kind of thing. But really, that I think it comes from a former model of modernity where there was still a society, right? So this idea of work. So if you're a Christian here, you've probably come across the term social gospel, right? That kind of idea. And the idea there, I think, was that instead of the traditional gospel of Christ, that now society was the redeemer, right? If we can perfect society, then that would be the way of effecting change in the world. But that, I'm claiming that view of society has kind of gone now. And so people don't have that sense of belonging to one universal kind of body. And that's kind of my main kind of emphasis here. So, and then the agent, and this is something I'm glad Jock mentioned the Hate book, because he deals a lot with the idea of victimhood, you know, in the Coddling of the American Mind. So I'm actually going to feature him a little bit in a couple of these slides. Okay, so that's the big slide. Okay, so the main, I think, historian of higher education in America has been Lawrence Vesey. He wrote this book and published in 1965. His doctoral dissertation was at UC Berkeley. It was like 1,300 pages. Right? So this is the shorter version of like 500 some pages. But anyway, it's still, I think, the reigning treatise on what happened to the university. And he's coming at it from a neutral perspective. But he's seen now over decades big shifts in higher ed and wrote a book about it. So neither the Christian religion nor positive science nor humane culture proved capable of making sense out of the range of knowledge and opinion. Quote, the university was fast becoming an institution beholden to no metaphysic. So he began, I think, early on to cite that there was a crisis, if you call it that, of no ethos at all, like and struggling to figure out what that new one would be, but it doesn't seem to aspire to anything greater, you know. Let's see. Now, the series of slides I have now are going to be kind of this before and after scenario, so it'll go back and forth, and I'll mark it that way. So the first one, so let's make sure we have a handle on what is modernity, like what do we mean by that, by J.M. Bernstein. Basically, it's the specialization part that I was talking about with knowledges, but modernity is the separation of spheres, the becoming autonomous of truth, beauty, and goodness from one another, and from their developing into self-sufficient forms of practice, modern science and technology, private morality, modern legal forms, and modern art. And we can dwell on this a lot, but what I liked is the way he kind of summarized it, the idea that these things have been broken up and divided and supposedly have nothing to do with each other. They're totally impermeable kind of categories here. Then to contrast that, like I have a similar quote by Ennis Lyons about right now, right? The collapse of the modern, the new faith. So he does give it kind of a religious kind of category that, whereas Vesey was saying that there's no metaphysic. So I mean, this is a fairly recent quote. So Ennis Lyons is saying, well, actually, there is kind of a metaphysic. I mean, there is a religion here. It's just not what we normally think of as a religion. Okay. The new faith, and that's what we call it, rejects nearly every principle of liberal modernity. The existence of an objective reality that can be discovered by reason, the scientific method on enduring human nature, impartial equality before the law, secular pluralism, and the value of freedom of speech, which is one thing I'm going to look at a lot, the separation of the private and public spheres. So according to Lyons, it's again this theme of everything's collapsing. If it helps you to understand in terms of social media, that's where I see it. I mean, it's like totally collapsed, right? Like it's all private that's just spewed out there, right? There's no public realm, really, okay? And then just to carry on this theme, an older writing here. I don't know if any of you are familiar with political philosopher Hannah Arendt. I go back to this essay quite often, but fraternité, or brotherhood, as a universal. So fraternity, which the French Revolution added to liberty and equality of man's political sphere, that fraternity has its natural place among the exploited and humiliated, whom the 18th century called the unfortunates, les malheureux, and the 19th century, the wretched, les misérables. So what I like about this is she's talking about these large classes, really, these categories, but she's saying, and she's talking about the French Revolution, the idea of brotherhood, you know, that kind of universal ideal that everyone aspired to, that was something that was distinctive about the modern period. I could talk more about Hannah Arendt. I'll just mention really quickly. So she's one of the German Jews that fled Germany because of the rise of Nazism and then went to New York with a bunch of other people. The context of this essay, it was a speech. She was invited back to the city that she had to flee from, to Hamburg, and was being offered the key to the city. So then she goes back to Hamburg. So you can imagine all these feelings that are drumming up. She was in exile. She had to leave, and now she's being welcomed back. And so, do I want to be welcomed back? And so actually she goes through so the notion of forgiveness from her point of view as well. So it's a very powerful read. It's called On Humanity in Dark Times. It's part of this essay here. Okay. Actually, people are kind of going back to Hannah Arendt now because of what's happening in the university, in our culture, with the rise of totalitarianism thought. So they're kind of going back. That was maybe her most famous work, is The Origins of Totalitarianism. Okay. Then now I'm going to do the after. So what I'm calling from universal fraternity to individual pronoun. This is Henry Louis Gates Jr., who's the director of African American Studies at Harvard. I think it has a different title now, but he wrote this back in the 1990s, so he's seen this kind of the emergence of what we now call critical race theory, but perhaps it was inevitable that the citizen at the center of classical Enlightenment political theory would be replaced by the infant at the center of modern depth psychology. The inner child may hurt and grieve as we have been advised. Is it also to vote? Okay. So he's kind of, I like it, I paired it with the Arendt because he's saying, okay, so that was an old model of modernity and being a citizen in a democracy, and now we seem to have a different kind of individual before us, and can that individual function in a democracy? Can you have a democracy this way? Okay, then a couple other ways of framing the same thing, something... So this notion of the universal man, universal humanism, I think was really crystallized at the end of the Second World War with the collapse of European civilization. So there's that important context. What I'm calling the equality of sameness. So the idea that equality was defined as everyone basically being kind of the same, being identical. And that was kind of the reigning model of what it meant to be equal. And then I thought gave its maybe most succinct expression at the end of World War II with the United Nations Declaration. We, the people of the United Nations, determined to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, the dignity of the human person, equal rights of men and women and of nations large and small. And again, this is because this comes on the heel of a total collapse, right? So how able they were, it's recognizing that this hasn't actually worked out this way. Okay, but and then as a contrast to that, the collapse of the universal, Equality of Difference, written by a fairly new journal, Journal of Free Black Thought, by John O'Hara. This one's a little longer, but I thought it was important. So, blackness with a capital B, question mark. The cultural understanding of the very term black is itself shifting from describing a racial ethnic minority that has historically participated in and often led a broadly American struggle for emancipation to an essentialist subgroup, now beginning to situate itself outside the historic framing of the pursuit of liberty and equality in the U.S. This is a change, in other words, from black to black, a capitalization that reflects a change in the view of the historic meaning of America and the relationship of its citizens to that history. So O'Hara here is also, I mean, this is kind of in the midst of a lot of the riots and the with the Black Lives Matter movement, and without getting into a whole lot of that, I think what I liked is a way of crystallizing this issue, that we now have a definition of, and it doesn't just have to be black, it's basically a virtually uncountable set of subgroups that no longer identify with the universal aims of the founding of the country. So that's kind of the big issue here. I'm going to go back to Henry Louis Gates to talk about the ramifications of that. And this was written in 1993 in the New Republic, so, you know, like 30 years ago or so more. Civil liberties are regarded by many as a chief obstacle to civil rights. The byword among many black activists and black intellectuals is no longer the political imperative to protect free speech. It is the moral imperative to suppress hate speech. It's a really wonderful article. I mean, he's reacting and responding to the development of, at least at Harvard, of certain key founders of what we now call the critical race theory. But I'm not going to really, I'm just focusing on one aspect of CRT. In the question, I don't know if we have time for questions now, but if we have questions or over lunch, I'm happy to talk about it more. What is that? Is it different than critical theory? Like, what is critical theory? And, you know, but I'll just input right now. It's not one thing, and it's lots of different things, you know, but anyway. So, but one of the things I'm looking at is they purposely attacked sort of free speech, that idea, okay? And also then kind of have now been distancing themselves from the legacy of Martin Luther King, which is really curious. And this has been happening the last several years. This is, of course, the March on Washington. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when nobody will shout white power, when nobody will shout black power, but everybody will talk about God's power and human power. This is fairly late for King, right? It's 1967, and he was a pretty complex character. So you can find all kinds of interesting, perhaps contradictory kind of comments or statements that he's made, and they're all kind of helpful. I guess the one thing that I mentioned is now, you know, his famous idea of colorblindness, right, is being somewhat rejected or distanced from. And I never thought that would happen in my lifetime, because he was like on this pantheon of great American, you know, civil rights leaders, whatever. But he's being demoted now in certain circles. Okay. Just given his stature, I don't think they're going to be able to get rid of him. But nevertheless, it's interesting what's happening right now. The one thing I will say is I think it's a valid point that some of the reforms that were brought in by the civil rights movement by King may have had more relevance in the South than in the North, where other blacks lived. And they were dealing with more economic issues in terms of loss of factory jobs. And so there's a lot of kind of economic polls going on too. But nevertheless, like the concept, I think, of colorblindness was his big contribution there. And then an interesting, this is actually Charles Lawrence, who's now at the University of Hawaii in Manoa. He was one of the early sort of CRT founders as well. I thought this quote was really fascinating. He says, I fear, and this was written also like 1990 or so, I fear that by framing the debate as we have, and these are other people working along him, as one in which the liberty of free speech is in conflict with the elimination of racism, okay, we have advanced the cause of racial oppression and placed the bigot on the moral high ground, fanning the rising flames of racism. So it's a really interesting acknowledgement early on, like, okay, this could whole thing could backfire on us, right? You could actually cause people to be sympathetic with people that we consider to be outright racist, you know, and then people will, it'll fuel that on the basis of their loss of civil liberties, okay? Let me then, I'm going to shift a little bit. I think I'm done with all the CRT stuff and the philosophical stuff, but I'm going to go down to the hate. There's another kind of approach, an accompanying development of analysis on why the loss of free speech or civil liberties is occurring, especially on college campuses. And that's where I think Jonathan Haidt has done a really valuable work as a secular Jew. He formed the heterodox economy. Great minds don't always think alike. Okay, the idea that what you used to think of as a traditional university, you know, the idea of exchange of ideas, the marketplace, all that, you contest them and the most valid idea wins out and, you know, that kind of thing, which is largely not happening as much as it used to. And he has a couple of things. One, if you know, for parents here, it's good because he does a lot of stuff on social media, right? So that's interesting. He cites that as a main cause. But the other thing has to do with the lack of diversity in higher ed. And then this is a graph I pulled from his presentation. So he calls it the American professoriate ratio. So the ratio of Democrats to Republicans, liberals to conservatives. So and in 1996, with these surveys that were conducted, it's about 2-1. And then by 2011, it's about 5-1. Now, this is all fields, all universities, dental schools, like, you know, everyone. It's obviously now, maybe not so obvious, but it's much, much greater at the current. And I think Brown University wins the prize. I think their ratio is 60-1 right now, right? So his point is college students are not hearing a diversity of views. So they're becoming narrower, narrower and narrower because they don't have any many options left. And as even as someone at a Christian college like Pepperdine, there is a reluctance for people who might speak out against what's going on. And if you have a different opinion, there's this thing you just keep silent because you're not sure if it's safe to speak out. And this is even at Pepperdine, right? And partially, I think it's because people haven't studied enough to know how to speak into a situation. So, I mean, I've been in sessions where people have said, okay, so you don't have to articulate why you're against something. If you're on a committee or whatever, you just lift yourself out of that situation and say, I digress from that position. So it's kind of an out. So if I don't know where you all are living and working, but if you find yourself in those positions, I think that might be a little helpful. So you don't feel that you have to answer, and argue down kind of the positions that you're disagreeing with, but you can simply state, I disagree with that. I mean, I'm just going to step out of that. I don't affirm that, and just leave it at that. Anyway, so again, I won't get into it. He's got this whole parallel that he tries to make with, the helicopter parents and overuse of, sanitizer wipes and everything, and all that. That he's connecting maybe the lack of resilience and tolerance towards germs and bacteria, and so he's making a parallel with that. With what's happening more in the realm of ideas, okay? So people are easily triggered now by things and on an emotional level. And it's important not to discount the trigger, but to try to understand it, because it's probably real for them, right? So it's a figuring out a way, then how do we like de-escalate that? How do we deal with that? But I think it's real, okay? This is my one example of that. Yale 2015, the Halloween debacle. Maybe some of you know about that. So the administration at Yale sent out an email to the entire school about Halloween costuming, and then refrained from dressing like another culture and all that kind of thing. And then Erica Christakis, who system at Yale is you have like den parents, you have people who actually live in some of the dorms with people, and that was Erica and her husband Nicholas, who's pictured there in the blue, and she sent out an email. And these are all kind of 60s people, right? So they're all about freedom of expression, free speech, and all that. And so this is from the email. Have we lost faith in young people's capacity, in your capacity, to ignore or reject things that trouble you? Whose business is it to control the costumes of young people? If you don't like a costume someone is wearing, look away or tell them you are offended. Talk to each other. Free speech and the ability to tolerate offense are the hallmarks of a free and open society. What was shocking, I think, to a lot of people around the world was the mob went after her for that. And if you want to YouTube it, you can see, because they went outside and they were screaming, crying, and surrounding her husband, who tried to explain things and in as civil way as possible. But I think the trigger was genuine. Okay, so it's a question of how did we get here? Like, how did this happen? Right? That you can't tolerate something like that in an email, right? So, okay. Another area, I think, in the greater society, I'm calling it the anti-universal woke left. Okay, so the ACLU, which historically has been champion of free speech. So there was an interview of David Goldberger. He was the attorney who defended the neo-Nazi group who marched in Skokie, Illinois, which is, I guess, mostly a Jewish community. And he defended their right to do that. Okay. And then this interview from the New York Times, I got the sense it was more important for ACLU staff to identify with progressive causes than to stand on principle. Liberals are leaving the First Amendment behind. Since 2016, the ACLU budget has nearly tripled to more than $300 million as its lawyers doubled. The same number of lawyers, 4, specialized in free speech as a decade ago. Okay. So you have a few brave individuals that are willing to kind of speak out against this. But what has been interesting for me to see is it's not just on the left, but I'm calling it the anti-universal woke right. So the Christian particularism. And I'm just picking on one thread, one point in this book. It's mostly in a footnote, actually. There's a lot to commend about this book. I haven't finished reading it myself, but the part that I read, I thought, had a lot of good points, but what I honed in on was this idea that even on the right, there seemed to be the same position as you were getting on the left, that we no longer identify with the country, the founding kind of ideas of liberal democracy. So let me just quote, "In the face of ethnic identity politics, we see Western man retreating to universality, to the universal values of the Declaration of Independence. He perpetuates the conditions for ethnic identity politics. Western man is trapped in a cycle of universality, unable to wake up into and embrace his own particularity." So there's a deeper read that you can do, but what's fascinating is that now you've got I just call it the woke right. You probably have another name for it, I don't know. But that the same response is happening. And it was kind of bound to happen because pretty much every institution in our society has now been taken over, right? So whether it's museums, government, U.S. foreign policy goals, I already mentioned universities, media, corporations. I mean, there's hardly an area that hasn't been taken over. It's actually kind of interesting. I kind of wonder, if you think of it as a religion, I wonder if that was what it was like to be in the Roman Empire in the early centuries, when another religion took over, so maybe now we're just, you know, getting our comeuppance, so to speak. Okay, so then extending it a little further, left and right, systems and origins talk. So I'm going to try to pull more of a commonality thread. So, of course, with the Nicole Hannah-Jones, 1619, racism runs in the very DNA in this country. So that's kind of part of her opening essay of that project. What was interesting to me, though, is this other one, and this is just one example, is in Twitter, that is associated, actually, with that other book, Stephen Wolfe. Racism is interwoven into every facet of society because race is natural. And since society is racist, it is best for society to be demarcated along racist lines. Let whites socially combine with whites, blacks with blacks. A racially neutral society is impossible. So I think that kind of shows you kind of. Now, I have to say, this individual has since recanted, right? He was challenged openly. He's working with his pastor, his elders. He had a position of leadership in his community. So I didn't use his Twitter handle or name him at all. Like, he's working through all this. And believe me, there are more extreme quotes than this that you can find on Twitter. But anyway, okay. But again, so the unity of it. So I'm going to shift now from talking about some of the philosophic shifts and some of the things going on campuses. Even at Pepperdine, I wanted to mention, I'm on a committee that is overhauling the general education program, which at Pepperdine is long. It takes like 2 years to complete your GE credits, you know, or core requirements. And so we're kind of, well, what do we want to do with this? So you can imagine, right, you've got some more activist types that are wanting to push forward, you know, their agenda. And then so a lot of interesting conversations have been coming out of that. And what struck me, though, is once we had a draft of our aims of the GE and, you know, why you take literature, history, the science, why everyone should take it, you know. And then this one professor stood up and really objected to the word truth as being used in the document. And he was an outlier, but it was just interesting that that came out. So I'm thinking, I mean, I didn't know this person personally, but I thought, I'm the way, the truth, the life. Christian University, like, you don't want to use that word anymore? Is that kind of fallen, you know, out of favor? It's now, granted, words are, you know, need to be defined, and people have a gazillion ways of defining truth and what they mean by that, right? So, but I think it's still a useful term, and that. But that was kind of the interesting thing that happened even at Pepperdine, right? Okay. The other thing I wanted to mention, though, with the systems talk is, it's this idea that the whole thing is, like, totally corrupt, right? That there's deep embedded, I mean, DNA talk is that kind of thing, right? So I consider that kind of like bad Calvinism, okay? So the idea that everything is so terrible, that everything that you do is of no worth whatsoever. You know, you don't even deserve to exist, really. Kind of, you know. But as opposed to thinking, everything is tainted, so everything, even man's noblest, best intentions and works, might have something about it that's selfish or corrupt in some other way, or, you know. But that doesn't mean that the whole thing has to be tossed out, or that there's no good at all, right? It's more of a mixed bag, maybe, but, you know. But this discounting of everything, which has been kind of interesting for me to see. Okay, and other people have identified it too, if you're interested in that. But okay, so I'm going to shift now and try to bring kind of a biblical case for identity in the remaining time that I have. So the case for biblical identity, spiritual adoption of a people, race, priesthood, nation. I'm looking mostly at race and nation. And what I'm hoping to do is to show that we have an alternative model. This is something I've been kind of working on over the years. Through adoption, spiritual adoption, tied to the Abrahamic covenant, okay, that I think is a powerful way of understanding how to break down those kind of racial silos that we now are in, and that the kind of the new kind of racialism that seems to be the reigning ideology in some circles, anyway. So the radical, I'm calling it the radical nature of the Abrahamic covenant, Okay. I Contain Multitudes. There was like a Dylan song not too long ago that was called I Contain Multitudes. So I really thought it fit. And I think he's quoting Walt Whitman as well, so there's layers of that going on. But so what I mean, and I'm going to look at these briefly, spiritual adoption and the orphans of God. Abrahamic covenant. 5 points. Laughing about legacy. Repudiating generative sex. Looking at circumcision. Blending inclusivity, the Hebrew and the non-Jew, sacrificing kinship, the example of Isaac, adopting the world, Father Abraham branches out. Okay. The first one, which you probably, the Lord and the last laugh, I will give you a son, I will bless her, she shall become nations, kings of peoples shall come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? The way of women had ceased to be with Sarah, so Sarah laughed to herself. The Lord said to Abraham, is anything too hard for the Lord? So, I mean, it was actually a physical birth, but through a miracle means, I think we could say. So there is kind of an interesting thing. I mean, you still need the legacy. You need the, you know, the sand and the sea and the stars and all that. So there is, you know, they're actual people, right? So it, but the possibility of that legacy, at least through Isaac, is coming through, I think, a miracle birth, you might say. And then looking at this idea of inclusivity, well, a little bit more, I guess, first here with the actual circumcision. And God said to Abraham, this is my covenant which you shall keep between me and your offspring. After you, you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins. Every male throughout your generations, whether born in your house or bought with your money from any foreigner who is not of your offspring, shall surely be circumcised. So the point that I'm drawing out of this, I mean, I know at least in Reform circles, circumcision is kind of connected to baptism in the New Testament. What kind of struck me is, of course, this is the male sex organ, and they have a hard enough time getting, you know, a legacy going in the traditional, quote, way. And then God introduces circumcision. Okay, so I'm seeing that as a repudiation of male sex in a way, not generative, not biological. Okay, I mean, of course, well, we'll get into that later. But okay, and then just drawing some of the inclusivity theme out of that from Tim Padgett, who speaks here sometimes. Slaves in biblical Israel were physically identical to masters. Even those slaves who were not born Israelites were to be Hebraized, made into Israelites through circumcision, and then fully invited into the social and religious life of the community. The blessings of God's promises to Abraham were applied to those so engrafted into his family. So what I like about what Tim is drawing out is the idea that circumcision was not limited to just the Jews, and it was a way of also bringing people together, right? Now, sacrificing kinship, biology is not destiny. Okay, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and sacrifice him there as a burnt offering. I will show you. Abraham built an altar, arranged the wood. He bound Isaac, laid him on the altar. Then he reached out his hand, took the knife to slay his son. And of course, you know, we know the story. So Isaac survives. So, and this is a really difficult story, right? I mean, you can talk about it in terms of the future sacrifice of Christ, and, you know, there's all those dimensions to it. But it would appear that he was really going to do this, okay? And then he was ready to do it. So, again, just kind of the framework that I'm using, I kind of like this idea of underscoring, if there's going to be a legacy, it's not necessarily going to be dependent on kinship relations. Okay, so that's kind of what I'm taking out of it, and you can decide for yourself what you think about that. But that's kind of where I'm going with that. Again, non-generative. Okay. Then I'm going to try to expand it a little more philosophically, the universal principle of adoption, I'm calling it. And this, you know, we adopted 2 boys as well, so a lot of this is just come from our own experience. But as I thought about it more, I realized there's a lot more going on here than just our family, okay? So that's what I'm calling the human condition, tying it to that, the reality of abandonment. So basically, it's the reality of death, okay? So all of us will be abandoned by our own parents one day in death, or maybe already have. We will abandon our own children as well. This is part of the reality of the fallen world. So rather than see kind of the plight of the orphan or, you know, adoption as a reconciliation of that, as kind of this special group, it seems to be front and center. It seems to be central, like, to the human condition, in my mind, anyway. And then expanding that, the universalizing principle of adoption, the new normal, from Romans 11, you, although a wild olive shoot, by the way, Gentiles, were grafted in among the others and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree. And if they, talking about the Jews, do not continue in their unbelief, will be grafted in, for God has the power to graft them in again, grafted back into their own olive tree. So what's really interesting to me here is that even for the Jew, now has to be adopted as a way of entering into this natural olive tree, if you will, right? So it seems to now be what I'm calling the new normal. This is kind of the way that God has set up for how this family is going to expand. And it made me reconsider even those famous, the famous sentence that Jesus utters, I think it was to Nicodemus, who was a Jew, right? That you must be born again, right? So, I mean, for years I just thought, oh, well, that's just a powerful metaphor, a way of talking about, you know, you have to start all over and not by your own work or whatever. And it is that as well. But I think it may be even more specific than that. It's the idea of a new birth. And that new birthing into a new family is the path of adoption. So I'm trying to blend these things. So the equality of sameness and the equality of difference that I think is in a biblical foundation of identity, I'm calling it the neither and the many of you. So in this verse in Galatians 3, very famous, quoted all the time, acknowledging that there are all these different groups out there, right? But that there's also a unity in Christ. Okay. So for as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. You are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you're Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to promise. So he kind of pops up again, right? Okay. This, I mean, people in our school, they're, you know, emailing this verse, and which is great, but it seems to me that there's a lot more to unpack here within the context of the way the Bible presents this notion of identity. It's not that there's no differences. The differences are there, right? But if I understand the argument, the differences don't count, that you're all one in Christ. You're still different, right? And that's kind of a hard thing, I think, for people to reconcile as modern people, being so, you know, egalitarian inside of us that we don't realize notions of equality usually have a hierarchy that they draw their meaning from, you know? So if it's unity in Christ, there's the hierarchy of Abraham, right? I'll get into that a little bit more. But there's also the hierarchy of the state that basically regulates our notions of democracy. So that's there as well, right? Okay, so this is not an eye exam, but I'm just simply showing you, again, where the context of that comes from. Neither Jew nor Greek, all that. I want to read that again. But the next I'm going to highlight, so Abraham is mentioned about 8 times in that chapter, okay, leading up to those famous verses. So, sorry, but that's patriarchy, okay? That's definitely the unity is being afforded by kind of this reigning principle of Abraham, which is, seems like it's dovetailing with the idea of unity in Christ, right? And I think I actually can play my videos if this works. So what I'm going to do now is try to pivot so that all the stuff I've been talking about with biblical identity and adoption, it seems to me that that may be our way out of our dilemma, perhaps culturally as well. Instead of being kind of siloed into these different groups, however way they're defined, that there's a way to adopt a cultural heritage, whether, you know, a cultural background, whatever it is, even if it might not superficially on the surface seem like that is, quote, yours, which I think that is highly questionable, nevertheless. But anyway, so to illustrate that, I've got a couple of video interviews. The first one is by Glenn Laurie, who was the first African-American to receive a PhD in economics at Harvard. And I'll let him kind of speak in his own words here. Let's see.
I mean, I'm thinking two things. I'm thinking, first of all, the inhabitants of antiquity, of the ancient world of Greece and Rome, were not white. They weren't white. They were Greco-Roman. They were like Turanian, but they weren't white. That, it makes no sense. That's an anachronism. That's projecting something back with millennia and imposing it on a structure where it made no sense. The other thing I'm thinking is that we, descendants of Africans who now live in the modern West, are not Africans. We're Westerners. Our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, et cetera, et cetera. English is my mother tongue. It was my mother's mother tongue. It was her mother's mother tongue, et cetera. I'm as close to, I don't know, Tolstoy, Shakespeare, Cicero, as I am to anybody who ever wrote, if they wrote, Swahili or spoke in the oral tradition of Swahili. This is my world. The West is my world. So there's something very artificial about the identitarian move that's being made here, where we take the corpus of human culture, which we inherit in the 21st century, and we parse it and chop it up and hand it out to our contemporaries based upon categories of racial identity, which made no sense in the times in which they these texts that we have inherited from the ancients were actually written. I'm not into it. If they say, is there a black economics? I mean, you know, how could there be a black economics? There are a set of questions that may be of more interest to certain people in virtue of their identity. You can pursue those questions, but the methods by which you assess the evidence that bears on those questions, by which you construct conceptual frameworks to articulate and interrogate those questions, those methods are universal. They're not, they don't adhere to a particular culture or a particular way of seeing the world.
And then my next clip is from, again, Henry Louis Gates speaking about a personal experience he had as an undergrad at Yale when the writer William Styron came to speak.
I first became aware of Bill Styron because of the publication of Confessions of Nat Turner. The novel was published my senior year of high school, 1968. And I read, because I was reading everything about black people. It was the Black Power Revolution, Black Arts Movement, and I was hungry for things black. I first saw Bill Styron when I was a sophomore at Yale. People were outraged that this white man, a white man from the South, would write about one of the sacred moments in African-American history when slaves rose up and slayed their masters. And so they invited them to come to campus so they could beat them up. No, I wasn't part of that dialogue, which I don't think was much of a dialogue, but I did see his face when he walked out of the room. I happened to be leaving another class, and I looked over and someone said, that's a William Styron who wrote The Confessions of Nat Turner. And he looked ashy. But I remember thinking that this was patently unfair, that there was something dishonest about the exchange. Because the exchange turned on the fact that he was white, and why should a white man, how could a white man have the authority, the authenticity, the moral claim to write responsibly about an event in African-American history? But by extension, if my fellow students had only thought about it for a nanosecond, any racist could use the same argument to keep me from writing about Shakespeare. Anyone has the right to write about any subject available to be written about. That's what the Academy is all about. That's what art's all about. That's what the pursuit of truth and representations of historical events imaginatively of necessity must be about. And I thought that Bill Styron did a brilliant job.
I just have a few remaining slides. Not strictly speaking necessarily in the university context, but those of you that are familiar with the classical Christian school movement, you now have kind of an interesting development where you have African Americans teaching in that and starting programs in Western classics. Doing, you know, and they're also, they're using it in very creative ways. So this is one example, I think at UVA, Angel Parham. My organization's program combines Homer's Odyssey with paintings by African-American artist Romare Bearden that reinterpret the tale as an allegory of the transatlantic African diaspora. Okay. And then just one more example, another one. Amber Johnson, in my house, Charlotte Mason has an afro. Okay. Why not? From a different kind of context, Masaaki Suzuki, who's one of the top three or four Bach specialists in the world. But when being interviewed, like, what are you as a Japanese conductor doing, you know, with Bach? You know, and we were very surprised that they thought Japan and Bach don't go together. Bach's music is a universal language. Every child who starts playing the piano plays Bach at some point, and everybody who goes to a conservatory has to study Bach. Nobody is a stranger to Bach's music. And you can make an argument, I think, probably the average Japanese individual is more trained in Western classical music, can probably play an instrument more so than an American is apt to, you know. I don't know. I'm guessing it's kind of anecdotal, but it clearly is not just limited like to one people, right? And it certainly doesn't have like a racial marker. Like I just anyway, a couple of other slides now to show you some alternatives. So this I think is starting its full year run this year. The University of Austin. I just have a few individuals here. But Barry Weiss, that you may know, a Jew, has been a leading agent of this new venture, an actual physical university. It's not a Christian university. Her byline, you know, we can't wait for universities to fix themselves. So she decided to start one, okay? And got hundreds of millions of dollars within days, right? Very illustrious group of people. There are Christians and believers, there are Jews, there are atheists, there are all kinds of people coming together to try this venture of a non-censored approach to education. You know, now, I kind of liken it to maybe a more liberal version of Hillsdale, which is also that kind of approach, but Hillsdale is not, my understanding, Christian, doesn't have a religious tradition, but it's conservative. And so they wanted an alternative. Because usually when people talk about this project, they think, well, we already have Hillsdale. Like, why do you need, you know, another one? And they're saying, yeah, but that's a different kind of, you know, set of values as well. So now the big question, though, and this is where, you know, forming, you know, allies with people in the culture, this is going to be a big challenge for Christians, I think, because there's a lot of issues that we don't share necessarily with these people, right? So you're beginning to see a kind of a fraying or trying to figure out, like, how do we work together? Can we work together on certain things and not on other things? And they're having to sort that out right now. So that's a really interesting case. And then the final one, among the Catholics, right? So Catholic Polytechnic, it's a new university that's starting in LA that's trying to be like a STEM college, basically, but one that tries to wed faith and science. How do they put it? Giving glory to God through science, technology, and engineering, you know. So this, again, is a brand new venture. I think they're not quite started yet. Maybe in a couple of years is my understanding. But anyway, so there are some attempts out there to do it. There's, of course, we want to reform the universities and work within them, but that's got its challenges as well. So some people are just feel it easier to have a clean start and do something brand new. I don't know. And, of course, you know, this is no coincidence it's Catholic, right? So from my limited experience, I mean, like, they've got the platform and they've got the resources to be able to do this kind of stuff. We don't really even have a Protestant on the Supreme Court anymore, right? So we're not, I mean, we're talking about culture and shaping and all that, which is tremendous, but we don't seem to be main players in that area. We're trying to fix that, but it may be a difficult environment to be able to fix that. I have no kind of a conclusion on that one, but that. But that's just where we find ourselves in. But it's really encouraging, I think, to even see among atheists, agnostics, secular Jews coming up with the University of Austin, but then also just Catholics coming up with their own kind of institutions as well. And of course, these kind of meetings and a lot of the Christian Study Centers too.